This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'd like to introduce Aunty Faye Stewart-Muir to give the welcome to country.
Wominjeeka, everyone. I'd like to welcome everybody here tonight to Bunurong and Wurundjeri country and pay my respects to my elders and their elders and to any elders that are here tonight with us, and especially to our fellow interviewees that are sitting up the front. And a big welcome to Daniel.
Thank you, Aunty Faye. I also acknowledge Bunurong and Wurundjeri ancestors. This is your country, and thank you so much for your permission to walk. I promise to walk, tread softly on this country. Brendan, joining the panel, Brendan Kennedy. We'll introduce him in a moment. This panel is called... There are some seats at the front for First Nations members of the audience, but if you feel that you want to get closer, by all means, these chairs are reserved, but if you'd like to move forward and be a little bit more familiar with the panel, you're more than welcome to come forward. So the panel conversation tonight is called Pass It On, Preserving Australian Indigenous Languages. My name is Daniel Browning. I'm the producer and presenter of Away, the Indigenous Art and Culture program on ABC Radio National. I'm the editor of Indigenous Radio. There are many Aboriginal words in everyday use by both non-Indigenous and Indigenous Australians. Words like kangaroo, galah, waratah, dingo, barramundi, corroboree, and languages embedded in our place names. Bondi, Wagga Wagga, Ballarat, Benalla, Koroit, and the list goes on. So what do we gain from knowing and learning First Nations words? And how can we embed more traditional language into the daily lives of all Australians? They say at least 250, but I reckon it's closer to 300 distinct Indigenous Australian languages were spoken on this continent in 1788. Today, only around 120 languages are spoken in homes. And most of these are considered, if not just endangered, critically endangered. For many years, elders have been working hard to document, share and promote Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages across the country. But in the UNESCO International Year of Indigenous Languages, there's an especially strong momentum building around our languages. In this conversation, our panellists will discuss campaigns across the country to revitalise Indigenous languages. They'll talk about the beauty and the knowledge contained, embedded within our languages and the efforts to preserve them. This event is Auslan interpreted, and the interpreters are Dave and Benji. This event is also being live streamed. I'd like to introduce the panel. Aunty Faye Stewart-Muir, who gave the beautiful welcome to country, is a Bunurong elder of the Yalakut Willem of the Bunurong, Wemba Wemba and Wagaya clans. Aunty Faye's worked for the Victorian Aboriginal Corporation for Languages, VACL. You'll hear that word a lot tonight. And for over 10 years, she's worked there as a cultural educator and language specialist, specialising in the Bunurong language, the language of Melbourne. Aunty Faye has been on a journey of language revitalisation, generously sharing her experiences with audiences. Can you please welcome Aunty Faye? Thank you. And next to me, Vicky Cousins, a Gunditj Mara woman from the Western Districts of Victoria. Vicky acknowledges her ancestors and her elders who've guided her work. She's worked in Aboriginal community affairs for almost 40 years. I can't believe that. 40 years. Vicky's contributions in the reclamation, regeneration and revitalisation of Indigenous language, cultural knowledge rather, and practice extend across the arts and creative cultural expression spectrum, including language revitalisation, ceremony, community arts, public art, visual and performing arts, and writing. Please welcome Vicky Cousins. Brendan Kennedy is the Deputy Chair of VACL, the Victorian Aboriginal Corporation for Languages. He's Wadi Wadi, Tati Tati and Mutti Mutti. He's also co-curator with Vicky Cousins of the River of Language exhibition at Bundjalaka over at the Melbourne Museum. Can you please welcome Brendan Kennedy?
Thanks.
Aaron Fazzo is best known for his appearance in ABC's Back Comedy, which was nominated for Most Outstanding Comedy Program at the 2015 Logies and won an actor for Best Direction. Aaron recently completed, I'm not sure how up to date this biography is. Aaron completed shooting Stephen McCallum's feature 1% and was seen in the Nine Network drama series Hide and Seek and Ivan Sen's feature film Goldstone, which opened the 2016 Sydney Film Festival. In 2016, his production company Lone Star, along with Bunya Productions, produced three by one hour drama documentary series on the history of the Torres Strait Islands called Blue Water Empire, on your screens now. Aaron is the narrator, I think, of Blue Water Empire, correct me if I'm wrong. He's one of three producers on the series as well. It's screening now on ABC One and iView. Please welcome Aaron Fazzo. And last but not least, Kelrick Martin is a Ngalama Bunuba man from Broome. He started out as a cadet radio broadcaster for Galari Media in Broome. He moved to Sydney in 1998. He presented ABC Radio Nationals Away and was the inaugural presenter of ABC TV's Message Stick. In 2002, he completed a Master of Documentary Writing and Directing at AFTERS. And in 2007, he returned to WA to become NITV's commissioning editor. He formed Spearpoint Productions in 2010. Credits include documentaries such as Yagan, Outside Chance, Prison Songs, and a 2015 Actor Award nominee. Oh, sorry, another short drama, Carriole, I think it's called, Carriole, a 2015 Actor Award nominee. Kelrick was most recently the Indigenous manager for Western Australia's state screen funding agency, Screen West. He's currently head ABC Indigenous. Please welcome Kelrick. Aunty Faye, why do you think we should learn our languages? Blackfellas should learn their languages, obviously, but why do you think more widely we should learn our languages?
I think it's important that people that have been that have come here after Cook arrived is to speak the First Nations languages, because these tell a story of who we are, where we come from, and it's a lot of history in there.
And it's embedded in those place names.
It certainly is.
I know that when we spoke, you were a very generous guest, I think, as Brendan, and Brendan has been a guest of our series on Radio National's Word Up series, where we share three words in a very short podcast called Word Up. And you shared the word for autumn in Bunwurrung, the word that we would approximate for autumn, when the leaves start to fall. Manamit?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And another beautiful word, tandirum. Can you tell me about that word?
Tandirum is, or tandirum really, is when the Kulin Nation, the five Kulin Nations get together, and it's bringing their songs and their dancing and their culture together. They've got to be welcomed onto country. So that's what tandirum's all about, welcoming people onto country. But you've got to have that welcome to start with.
Vicky, I remember vividly this trip that we took into your country, Gunditj Mara country, around Warrnambool, and a place they know as what's called Hopkins Falls, mm-hmm. A part of the Hopkins River. And part of why I think our languages are so powerful and the place names are so powerful, because they tell a story, as Aunty Faye said. The falls, Hopkins Falls, the name in Gunditj Mara.
Yeah, it's Tangan Punot, and it's the place where the eels bite the stones. So the short-finned eels, or kuyang, they migrate out to the Coral Sea around about March, February, March, and they go out and the young glass eels come back to their home waters where their parents come from, like we do. We go back to our country and... that's where they climb up the falls by biting the stones and climbing up. So, yeah, that tells that story of that part of the Hopkins River.
And it's quite a fall. I mean, it's a long way that those eels have to bite the stones in order to return to their home waters.
Yeah. It's actually, I think, like one of the widest and not quite the highest falls, but...
It's high enough.
Largest, yeah. I've jumped off the top and had a swim there. But yeah, it's pretty deep.
So Hopkins Falls, I don't know who Hopkins was, but he
Mr. Hopkins, I don't know.
He got a river and some falls named after him. But for endless years, those falls were known by this beautiful name, which tells so much about their history and about what happened there.
Yeah.
That's the power.
And you know, downstream and then further upstream at the mission, there's each family would have a section of the river and have the weirs and the fish and eel traps, you know, to catch food. And you would probably, most people would know that the other half of the country, because Warrnambool Way is my grandfather's country and Hayward, Portland Way is my grandmother's country, and we just got World Heritage listing for our Budge Bim and the aquaculture systems over there. So, yeah, it's pretty important.
6,500 years old, that cultural landscape.
At least, yeah.
And what does that mean? I mean, obviously we're talking about languages, but this is so important. We're talking about cultural landscape. Language is a part of our cultural landscape as well. But that was a cultivated, engineered, a site of human ingenuity.
Yeah.
And it's been listed by UNESCO on the World Heritage List. It's now a protected site. It has international protection.
Yeah, it's absolutely awesome and amazing for us to be able to have... Well, the people who did all the work, I shouldn't say us because I'm just part of the mob, you know, to be able to achieve that and to have that recognised and, you know, it's rightful place and be foregrounded, so like our languages. And Aunty Faye and Brendan and I have been on ABC Radio at various times today talking about our languages and how important that is, and you talked about that at the beginning and how we have to all cherish our languages.
Mm. Well, congratulations to your mob, and I think that deserves a round of applause. Mm.
Thank you.
Aaron, when Blue Water Empire launched, you posted a message on Facebook in, I think it was in Kalakaua'ia.
Yep.
And Yumplatok.
Yep, Yumplatok.
Talk to me about those two languages. One is the language of Saibai, of those islands up towards the north of the Torres Strait.
Yep.
And then Torres Strait Creole. You grew up around those languages?
Absolutely. The Kalakaua'ia language is, I guess, belongs to the top western group, or the Guda Mualgal group, which is that of Saibai, Duan and Boigu, and that's basically the traditional language, what we call KKY, which is spoken up in that top northern region. Now, Yumplatok basically is, I guess, was introduced back at the in around the 1860s when Banner, I think we explained it in the documentary. Came with these men from the Polynesians, or the from Polynesia, basically, in search of beach demur or sea slug, and that particular Bislama, it was called, which is a form of broken English, but in a kind of more of a Polynesian context. They're not obviously spending time in around the Torres Straits. Because of the pearling boom, which came not too long after, mixing our language or Kalalagoya, Kalakaua'ia, and also Miriam Mir. Well, first and foremost, Miriam Mir, because that's the Eastern Islands were basically impacted initially by the missionaries, by any of those colonialists. You know, pre-colonisation or during that time, because of the East Coast, because of the
geography,
that access. Mm-hmm. So basically, Yumplatok is made up of Miriam or Kalakaua'ia and English as well, which is universally spoken throughout all the Torres Straits, whereas Kala Kawaya, Kala Lagawaya, and Miriam Mir are basically distinctive to those particular regions where those languages are spoken.
And was language spoken at home? Did you grow up on the mainland or did you grow up in on Saibai?
Well, I basically grew up in Bamaga. I mean, in 1947, a group of, well, my elders, basically, or forefathers, made the move from Saibai to Bamaga due to the water shortage and saltwater inundation, and settled to where we now know the place called Bamaga and Sasia, right there in the tip of Cape York. But the Kalakaua language was spoken, was spoken in my household. Thus, you know, English and Yumplatok as well. But definitely grew up with Kawaya and Kalalagoya as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was down kind of on the far south coast of New South Wales for a board meeting, and one of the board members is this woman, a Nigina woman from the Kimberley region, and her name's Annie Milgan. And I was talking to her granddaughter, Jennifer. And Annie is a custodian of story. She holds this beautiful story about Wunyambu, the journey of the night heron, and he transforms into a man. Incredible, incredible story about the origin of Nigina people. But I said to Jennifer, her granddaughter, who must be 15, 16, I said, "Oh, so you only speak Creole or English?" And she's like, "Oh, no, I speak six languages." And she's 15. And so I made this mistake of thinking that she would only speak English. She's from Luma community, a very small remote community in the Kimberley. And then Annie started talking, Kelrick, about, you know, it's important, you have to have, she said, "Oh, back to language, you have to have Nigina, you have to have Malgana, you have to have this language and this language, because if you get together and you can't talk to each other, what's going to happen?" So just the simplicity of just like, you have to learn more than one language. And I know that, Kelrick, where you come from Broome, the Kimberley, languages, it's in the air. Everyone has, will certainly in the past, had multiple languages. And then you introduced all languages like Japanese and Malay. I mean, it was a real melting pot in terms of just the language as well.
Absolutely. And as you say, it's one of those things where you kind of have to learn those things. But you also, as with Aaron's experience, it's kind of one of those things where it's a part of your learned experience as a child growing up. You're exposed to these things. You're exposed to different Indigenous languages, different languages from Asian countries, as you say, such as Malaysia and Singapore and China and Japanese and all this sort of stuff. So it really does become part of your fabric of who you are. Mm. And it's quite common for that to happen up there, for sure.
And in fact, I find when I'm talking to people for whom language isn't being reclaimed, for whom language is just a fact of life and there's no revitalization, it's just a language that they speak in tandem with others and with English, asking for them to choose three words is very tricky. It's like saying, "What's your favourite song?" Like, it's very, very hard. Mm. And I think people who are in revival, Vicky, people who are reviving their languages or in a kind of revival community, as many of us are, we see the inherent value of just knowing words, of just being able to say, "That's our word for wallaby, that's our word for this flower, that's our word for this season." But for people for whom language is not in revival, it's a difficult proposition to kind of sit back and go, "Oh, wow, languages are amazing." Well, of course they are, because we need them to talk. Yeah. Your whole, well, you know what I mean? Like, it's a hard thing to kind of go back and go, "Well, can you appreciate the beauty of it?" What I'm saying is, when you grow up without language or deprived of language, it becomes even more precious.
Absolutely. Mm. It's totally an imperative, and it's our birthright, and, you know, to grow up around language. And Brendan was talking about, and he'll probably talk a bit more, but, you know, we have language ways that we communicate, even though we're using English words. Mm. So we still have that, but we still don't have all our words. And then we get our words, but then how do we talk? Mm. So, you know, for me, I'm looking at our grammar, because we absolutely need that. to put all our words together so that we can be talking if one day. And my end game's fluent speakers, but, you know, that's going to take a long time. So in the meantime, we're doing everything that we can, and words are where we start.
Now, Brendan, Tatty Tatty, Mutty Mutty and Waddy Waddy. Mutty Mutty, we're talking, you know, around in the vicinity of Mildura.
Balranald, New South Wales.
Balranald, sorry, yeah. And Tatty Tatty and Waddy Waddy, places geographically with those languages.
Yeah, so that's I'm part of, there's actually six of those language groups that I'm a part of, and there's also Latchi Latchi, Yitta Yitta, Nara Nara and Weki Weki. We have neighbours that are Wamba Wamba, Brapa Brapa and Yorta Yorta further up. So they, all those languages along the Murray River area, they all mean no-no. So you notice how they're duplicated, tutty-tutty, so it's no-no. So we're known as the no-nos, the no-no peoples. But, yeah, just following on from what Vicky was saying, it's interesting because as I was painting the mural at the museum on the weekend, I was asked a question by a non-Indigenous person, and this person asked me how much traditional language is being spoken in Victoria, and my response was, well, how much traditional English is being spoken in Victoria when you consider Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Messenger and all of these new forms of, you know, communication. So, I mean, going on from what Vicky was saying, we've been speaking blackfella English, Aboriginal English, for a long, long time now, and we've just been using English, using that dialect. But we had to do that because our grandparents and great-grandparents were forbidden from speaking the language. So,
And punished.
So in secrecy, our people had to create a secret language, but also maintaining our non-verbal language, our sign language, and our facial expressions, and our avoidance. We also have an avoidance language where we don't use around certain people, including authorities and the white government. So. It's interesting because having taught language in schools, I really noticed that our children are really under threat of losing our Aboriginal English. They're being corrected in schools. Mm-hmm. So there's a double double-edged sword here. We're being denied or prevented from reclaiming our heritage language, but also we're having our Aboriginal English removed from us through the education systems.
What I love about Aboriginal English, and you know, in all of this, it's after standard Australian English, it is the most widely spoken form of English in the country. Now that's often forgotten because we can go up north, Kelrick, and have a conversation up there and understand what people are talking about when they're using words that, you know, have travelled, or words that down here have travelled. Words from where I come from, Northern New South Wales, have travelled. And Creoles too. I mean, they're all part of our language, our cultural geography. Mm. And retaining them and keeping them alive, I think, is really, really important. And it's interesting to talk about Aboriginal English because I'm thinking about a couple of episodes, a couple of sketches in black comedy, in fact. I think, Aaron, maybe you were in this one. Certainly, I think it was written by Stephen Oliver, and it's all nonverbal. And Stephen Oliver's having a conversation with someone across the road, and he's you know, you're doing the thrust of the. Sorry, I just spat very voluminously. Didn't mean to. That was
lucky no
involuntary.
One was sitting in the front.
Look out! Those First Nations mob, look out! a very quick thrust of the head, and usually the pointed lips has a lot of meaning, and you know, we can have a conversation without using a lot of words, but in that sketch, I think he's having a conversation with a brother, and you know.
Yeah.
But I think we still do that. I don't know. I don't know about you, Adi Faye, Vicky, yeah. Brendan. Yeah, we're still
doing that.
Yeah.
Rolling the eyes.
Oh, rolled eyes, very much so.
And, you know, we've got our own form of sign language too. Mm. I mean, different parts of the country have their own, and still in use, I believe. And certainly in the Torres Straits.
Very strong in Arnhem Land as well, sign language.
Yeah.
The kind of wrist twisting and the chin. Yeah. Stephen was telling a story, Stephen Oliver, the comedian, about he was having just yarning to some other black fella, and they were having a conversation about where this person was geographically, and the person he was talking to said, you know, she's up there, and like lifted the head up. They were in Alice Springs. She was actually talking about Darwin. So that quick thrust of the head can mean thousands of kilometres, or hundreds of kilometres at least. Vicky, your long kind of association with VACL, but with cultural arts and community arts and language, can you remember that moment? I guess it was probably, you know, your father was a huge influence on you in terms of your whole journey as an artist and as a language revivalist, which is how I would describe your work. But was there a moment when it kind of crystallised for you that this is something that you had to do, you had to continue to revitalise your language or work with language?
No, not a particular moment, but certainly when I did return back home in 99, actively took up working with Dad and you know, creating opportunities for learning language, and we set up our dance and cultural group, and you know, we created songs and dances. So yeah, bringing it back through living, and you know, like now, like I said, it's great that we've got words. Dad got our dictionary in 96. We still have no speakers. When are we going to have speakers? So I'm really focusing on that now, and that has been a moment a couple of years back where I've been getting frustrated with the words thing, you know, just throw a word in here and there, and that's fine. You got to do that, and people have to become familiarised and comfortable, because, you know, one of the obstacles is people being shamed because they don't know their language. They feel shame, so they get scared to say it because then they want to say it properly, and I'm like, just say it. You'll get to the proper bit, you know, if you keep saying it. But for me, it's I'm doing this grammar and I'm focusing. And we've got lots of digital things going on, you know, and that's deadly, but where's the living? It's got to live in people. So this is my focus, because I've now got 15 grandchildren who are 15 years old and younger, and, you know, my vision back in the day was that they'd be at least bilingual, and they're not. So what am I doing? I've got to get on with it.
Don't be so hard on yourself. But, I mean, that was going to be my last question to the panel, is, like, what is the end game? But I hope we can get to the object of what all of our language journeys and what they mean, and whether we want fluent speakers or we want people to know more language. I'd like to kind of draw you out on that a little bit later. Adi Faye, one conversation I had with you some time ago down at Phillip Island, I don't know if you recall, we were talking about forensic, I think with the word was forensic linguistics, where we have to work out from where the historical record is perhaps the only primary source material we have for our languages, unfortunately. We have to reconstruct from the record the language of the recorder, and understand what dialect of English they recorded our languages in.
That's right.
Yeah, talk to me about the difficulty of that forensic kind of approach.
It's because of the people that have collected our words, you know, some are Scottish, some are German, some are English, and it's the way they hear it. They write it down, completely different to what an Aboriginal person has said, but they've written it down this way because our language was oral language and we didn't write anything down. So it's really hard to, you know, you might have 10 different words that you've got to go through. And as I said, it's like a forensic audit that we've got to go through each word to find out the word or the spelling that we want. And then it's up to the community to say yay or nay.
And that's an interesting kind of development, I think, in this phase of language revival, of revitalization, is that many communities are deciding by committee that on pronunciation, yep, on spelling. Is that happening here with, yes, Bunwarang?
Yes, it is, definitely.
And another interesting thing, I'm always fascinated, I'm not from Victoria, I'm from far northern New South Wales, I'm Bunjalung and Cullerly from southwestern Queensland on my mother's side. But Vicky, I remember having a conversation with you about the word which we hear in Bunwarang and Kireiwarang, Dagwarang, Jabwarang, Warang. What's that word mean?
Lips.
Lips.
Lips. Lips.
And, you know, sometimes I thought it was tongue. It's not tongue.
No, no, no.
It's lips.
Lips, tongue.
Yeah.
It can be sort of a bit of both.
Yeah.
But it's your language as well. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm.
So in that Anifei, what would Bunwarang mean? Does it have a particular meaning? Is it just the
no
name?
No lips.
No lips.
Mm. Yeah. Bun is no.
And that's really interesting. And Brendan, you were talking about this yorta yorta meaning no-no, lachi lachi no-no. What many people don't understand is that when, to differentiate ourselves from each other in terms of our languages, we would say, these are the mob who say no, these are the mob who say yes in this way. So up north, Minjungbul means my clan or the people from my area, the people who say no, because their word for no is Minjung. It's different from the next mob. The next clan has a different word for no. So that's a really interesting way of classifying each other according to how we say these really important words, no and yes.
It is. I mean, up.
I think it's endlessly fascinating. Sorry. I think
it is. Because we actually border with Wiradjuri, which are, you know, one of the largest language groups in New South Wales, to our east. But to our west, we also border the Bakanyi. So it's interesting that Auntie mentioned Bun, because in my language, Bun means to bite. And so our words for no represents our... So if I say tadi tadi means no, but there's also, if we say a word that to go to say don't, we'll say tatai. Also, we'll make those changes to that first part of the word. But there's other groups in Victoria who refer to as yes, and they'll be like jar. There's a mob called jar jar. And so there's other closely related languages around them. So that's interesting. That's an ancient and old way of distinguishing about who the groups are. And my particular groups in Northwest Vic, we're part of Western Kulin languages. And there's also down here, aren't you part of the Central Kulin? Yeah. And there's also Eastern Kulin. And Kulin means the people. In my language, Mari Mari Kuli meant the people. We've got these different classifications, but really we're part of these language families, these large language families. And then within those big language families are the different languages, and then within the languages are the clans. And some clans will be bordered on a neighbouring language, so they'll be a bit of both, which is pretty much like if I'm married to brother's sister here, well, them kids can go his way and my way. It's the same with the language within the landscape. So we're so blessed. And all of you people are so blessed to have us here because in our country there are ways to look at the language that shows you how to live. And that's how our people have been living by the landscape for so long. Hence, we've got very old languages that are perhaps the oldest languages known to humankind.
And that's something to remember. There's also incredible linguistic diversity on the continent. I did ask a linguist from the University of Melbourne, how does Australia rate in terms of its linguistic diversity? She said it's pretty high, but Papua New Guinea is the most linguistically diverse place on the planet. Hundreds, over, if you consider the area, hundreds, if not thousands of languages. And I did say to this linguist, is that because, you know, the highlands, maybe they every valley needed a different language? She said, well, we don't know. We don't know why people speak different languages. But it is, for me, I think, and when we think about it, our country being particularly in relation to Papua New Guinea, Vicky, very flat.
Yeah.
So if you've got that mob over there, over that hill over there, they have to speak a different language from you. And it almost makes me think, why did we have different languages? Why did we find a different way to communicate? It's not distance, because sometimes you have languages, you know, right up against each other. Mm. But multiple languages. Something I've just thought about. I just went off on a complete tangent. I'm just really fascinated. I'm just really fascinated with
language. Well, from our perspective, we'll have five words for kangaroo.
And five words for kangaroo.
We will have five words for kangaroos. Now, one man, that was his name, that kangaroo, when he passed away, they'll stop using his name for a while, for a generation. And so the other group, they'll use that name for that kangaroo. So that's how all our languages are so different and changed over the land.
And also this idea too that, you know, they say there are a lot of words in English. I can't quite remember the number. I'm sure someone in the audience knows how many words there are in English. But in Aboriginal languages can be very economical, except when it comes to kinship. Mm. There might be a very complex set of relationships that are described in kinship terms, very specific, because kinship's really important, community's really important, culture's really important. And also this other thing that Richard Wally said, I think, to Stephen Oliver, was that we didn't need to deceive each other. We didn't need to lie. We didn't need a court. We didn't adjudicate matters in a court. We didn't need to deceive. We couldn't deceive people. Traditionally, we would have very straight words for straight interactions with people. You couldn't really lie. Again, I went off. Sorry. Anifei, you've published a book recently, I think last year, and it was a guide for, you know, school-aged children and also for teachers. It's setting out not just words in Bunurong and in other Aboriginal languages, but also words in Aboriginal English. Tell me a little bit about that publication.
It's sort of like a dictionary of words that we use every day, and because a lot of people don't understand, you know, what our kids are saying. So we've written it down, you know, like brother, like bro and sis and cuz and all those different words. You know, deadly, what does deadly mean? You know, a lot of people think, oh, God, what's this child doing? It's a deadly snake or it's a deadly whatever. But, you know, deadly means it's fantastic. It's the best. So it's a book that the teachers are using with the kids, and the kids are really, you know, learning more about Aboriginal culture through it.
Mm. It's a fantastic little book. The name of the book again?
Nunga.
Why can't I pronounce that?
Nunga. Where's your tongue?
Yeah, Nunga. Nunga, and it means to
know.
To know. Aaron, you know, in talking about linguistic diversity and the Torres Strait and all the languages spoken on the various islands and the Creoles, I would imagine that in terms of the threats to language would be even greater in the Torres Strait than perhaps, you know, some parts of Australia. And I say that because I think, you know, the exodus to the mainland or movements to the mainland and rising sea levels. I mean, I think language, what's the situation as you see it with language in the Torres Strait?
Look, the Torres Strait is no different to the other language groups and countrymen living here on the mainland in certain areas. Certainly in, you know, I mean, the two strongest or the three strongest groups currently or islands that are currently fluent in their language group is that of Saibai, that top western area, Saibai, Duan, Buigu, Badu and Mabiag, and also out there where Mare or Murray Island. Currently in the Central Island group, they're doing a revitalisation, repatriation into the Kalalagoya language group. And certainly, you know, because back in 47, when my forefathers made the decision to move to the mainland, now, you know, you've got a situation, and that was a situation where you've got two Torres Strait Island communities in amongst three Aboriginal communities. And you've got all those intermarriages now that occurred. Well, obviously. it's been interesting in terms of, you know, we speak differently in terms of Yumpla talk or a broken English there, because there's a mixture of mainland, Torres Strait and English there going on as well. Mm-hmm. There's also what we're finding as well, that there's also been a loss of the Kalakaua language. There's also a repatriation or revitalization, and actually my mother's along with Ate Dana Oba are one of the collectives that are looking at revitalizing the Kalakaua language. But there were others such as, you know, Alec Tipoti and Laurie Nona, those from the Guda Mayulgal group, as well as Gabriel Barney and all the work that they've been doing there at Mabiag to revitalise and repatriate the Kalalagoya language. Murray Island are quite strong. They've been, you know, on that, keeping their language and culture quite strong, you know, pre-Mabo anyway. But I think, you know, the other island groups have pretty much been on that same train as well. It just so happens that, unfortunately, due to the impact of the missionaries and also the influx of during that time of the Bislama period, a lot of not only the missionaries but also the Beach Timur days, the Trokus days, where a lot of Polynesians were coming through either to were either as a labour hire or maritime labourers or missionaries outlawed those particular language groups. Mibi Moreau in Mare on the Murray Island group kicked out, didn't allow any foreigners to live on Murray Island. In fact, when they did try to establish a mission site on Murray Island, he ended up booting them out and sending them to the neighbouring island of Erub or Darnley. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Saibai was off limits for any foreigners to actually, you know, try and set up camp there as well. So hence, it was only Saibai for Saibai. And when you look at the other islands that were either staunch or open to outside influences, I think you see that kind of playing out today when we speak about language, culture, or cultural preservation.
Kelrick, I think in the development of the script for Clever Man, one of the ABC TV series, which, you know, did a lot, I think, in terms of Wufukum Bangir language, a language from the mid-north coast of New South Wales, you know, you could have created your own language, but instead I think the writer on that series on Clever Man was very firm about the fact that Gumbangi language would be spoken, it would be spoken accurately. And he worked, I think, and you worked too with Uncle Gary Williams from the Murabai Language Centre. So there's language is appearing in our content, and a much more kind of mature and responsible approach to language in broadcasting as well.
Yeah, look, I think it was really important to do that. Clever Man, I think, was a groundbreaking program at the time in depicting Indigenous stories as these kind of like genre stories of like the futuristic sci-fi type of things. I don't know. I mean, yeah, we could have made up our own language, but you know, as you say, 300 odd to choose from here in Australia. Why would you, you know? So I think that was really important to do. But I think it's also important to do to contemporise Indigenous language. It's not about this kind of dusty thing behind a glass case in a museum. It's something that is lived, that exists, that breeds, that, you know, is a part of our everyday lives, as you were saying before about the Kimberley, you know. And, we use it all the time. We don't, because we're speakers, or, you know, we don't necessarily think about, you know, it is this language we are speaking. It's just a part of our lives. So I think it's really important from the ABC's perspective, particularly in the job that I do, is to make sure that if we are depicting Indigenous language, it is almost seen to be unremarkable, not necessarily this, you know, suddenly there's this thing and it's an Aboriginal language and everyone should pay attention. It's like, it's just normal, you know. We should normalise Aboriginal language, and I think it's really important. That's why I think we did that for Clever Man in particular, and we would probably continue to do that in other programming as well.
Anifei, what do you think are some of the threats to language revitalisation? And, I mean, it's something that it's a lifetime. It's not just something you do for a summer or a weekend. Learning language, if you don't have your language by yourself, can be a very long, difficult path to take. But what do you see as some of the threats to language?
I think some of the threats is that, you know, our kids are speaking English and or anything else, and they're quite comfortable in that. And when you try to sort of teach them when they're a bit older, they just said, don't want to do that. You've got to catch them when they're younger.
But the extraordinary thing, the renaissance happening in Indigenous languages is being driven by people who are over 50.
That's right.
And like they're the people who are doing stuff.
That's right. And we've just got to get these young ones interested in the language.
And I think there's, you know, I don't know if there's a Gunditjmara language app. Is there a language? I mean, there are so many language apps. There are, you know, they're technologising our languages, which is extraordinary, Vicky.
I think that's part of trying to make it relevant. Uncle Sandy was a great one for talking about making things relevant today, you know, for the young people and engaging them. Mm. So, I don't have a big answer on that, really, in how we can keep doing it when we're trying technology where, you know, and we're exposing kids. I think the thing is for them to become normalised, what we've just been talking about. And I think, you know, what Aaron was talking about is exposure to other things. There's so many choices that we have to really create those opportunities. And I know for myself, I'm going for immersion stuff. Because, you know, we can do the word things and that, but we need to create times where we go and are just immersed in it so that it does become normalised and easy, and you're not thinking about it too much. It's just trying to be normal.
And it's just this thinking, you know, forget English, think in language to get that that language spoken again.
Brendan, what do you reckon we can do to encourage our kids to speak language?
It's funny to hear that, like, technology is a threat, but it's also can be used as a strength of sort of redirecting our younger generations back to country. Definitely, look, I think education system in this country has to recognise and be willing to embrace our language within the curriculums.
It's the least the least you could expect, really.
It is, and so. I know the governments, especially government agencies that are involved in the environment, are really looking at embracing language. But I think the education system within all the states and territories need to really commit and look at, really understand and look at the real value of language towards not only our First Nations Indigenous children, but all kids in Australia. I think to be able to understand many languages, which we do have many languages in this country, is far more, I think, beneficial and more important than learning several languages from overseas.
Vicky, we haven't even spoken about your extraordinary collaboration with Deborah Cheatham on the war requiem, Umarala, about the Umarala Wars, which took place on your country in the 19th century. But just that experience of working with musician and linguist Chris Ira, to create choral music, sacred choral music, almost in the form of a Catholic mass, in this thing called a war requiem, crash course in, you know, classical music. I don't even know what I'm saying.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
but it was like that. I mean, you learn a lot about your own language in creating Umarala, this extraordinary collaboration.
Yeah. And that was a major work that has really helped along that whole grammar rebuilding, because I had to create new grammar as well as new words, because some of the concepts and the words, they weren't there. So I had to do this. Linguistics for us is a tool, you know, in part of that reconstructing and rebuilding. But then we have to, take that back into our cultural framework and redream it or relive, you know, get it living again, so that it takes on that cultural meaning. Because, like we talked about earlier, there's a lot of stuff that comes out of historical records, and we have to reinterpret that back through our cultural lens. So it was pretty amazing, and I learnt so much about, you know, requiem masses and, yeah, classical music that I didn't know.
But you learn about your language as well, what it can do.
You know. It's been very powerful.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I think my last question to each of you is that if we're having this conversation in 10 years, Brendan, what's the object, what's the end game for language revitalisation? Is it fluency? Is it that kids speak, that they're bilingual in English and in Wadi Wadi or Lachi Lachi or Mati Mati? What's for you the thing that kind of compels you forward in terms of language preservation?
I think there will be different views. Like, some views people will want have fluent speakers, and definitely that would be ideal to have some fluent speakers or semi-fluent. But definitely providing up opportunity to those descendants of those languages. So giving those descendants, whether they're living on country or living away from country, the opportunity to access their language. But also, I mean, hopefully we're seeing that we have even legislation in place right across the whole country, legislation that is embedded within the national legislative frameworks in order for our language to be recognised and preserved and protected and maintained for future generations.
Things like dual naming of sites, I think that would be one kind of
absolutely.
Long-term object.
I know, look, down here in Victoria, we're looking at dual naming of, you know, large institutions like the museum, and there's also naming of government offices here in Melbourne in the languages of Victoria. So we want to see, I'd hope to see a lot more language right across the whole society, right through every facet of society. And in particular, those particular local areas, that language at the local level is recognised and used more throughout those local areas.
Ani Faye, what kind of conversation should we be having in 10 years about languages? Where would you like that conversation to be at? Fluency?
I'd like to see the kids speaking it and sort of teaching the next generation, you know, the next little ones. They'd be the leaders.
Aaron, what about, where do you stand on you know, passing it on and preserving languages, this conversation in 10 years' time?
I think there was a comment, there was a comment, or one of the sisters at the recent NAIDOC ball, the awards in Canberra. It was the words to the effect too that if you've got to see it to be it. So in that reference, you've got to hear it to speak it. So I think over the next 10 years, certainly from my perspective, then in terms of the things that I'll be doing in my own little world in regards to this, is certainly making more, producing more film and television programs, either series or feature films, that will definitely be speaking either Kalakaua'i or Kalalagwa'i or Birimir language or languages. So yeah, you've got to hear it and speak it. And so if our kids aren't hearing it, and seeing it in different forms, and especially in the mediums that they're engaging with, because now, in terms of media, it's just blown off the Richter scale now. There's so many different ways and forms that we can engage with our kids, but also engage our elders too through those same mediums as well, where they have their place as well.
You've got to hear it to speak it. Could you please join me in thanking our panel?
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.